election. Well, reporter Jordan Dunbar has been telling me what the situation's like there. It's a big swing state for them. And we'll also take a look ahead to the WSL action later on today with Wales all-time top goal scorer Helen Ward.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 4 o'clock. This is Anna Cunningham. The boxer Daniel Dubois has retained his IBF World Heavyweight title, knocking out the two-time champion Anthony Joshua. 96,000 fans watched the All-British World title fight at Wembley Stadium. Dubois' father Dave said he always had faith in his son.
Unbelievable. You know, I'm so proud to be a part of something as mega as this. And I'm so proud that he delivered, as he said he was. He said he will knock him out. He did it in the fifth. So I always knew he could do it. And he's shown the world he's the real deal.
The Crown Prosecution Service says it reviewed possible charges against the former Harrods boss Mohammed Al-Fayed twice when he was alive, but concluded there was no realistic prospect of a conviction. Lawyers representing women who say they were raped or sexually assaulted by the billionaire have had 150 new inquiries since a BBC documentary aired last week revealing the allegations. Sir Keir Starmer has said it's his responsibility to do something about leaks coming from Number 10. Speaking to the Observer ahead of the Labour Party conference, he said leaks damaged everybody. Our political correspondent Alex Forsyth is in Liverpool.
Because of the week that the party's had, this week we've had all of that drip, drip constantly of stories about, you know, the gifts of clothing, the gifts of spectacles, the tickets for the football matches, the pay of Sue Gray. I think that has just set quite a difficult tone going into this conference, and there's like a consciousness that they need to find a way to deal with that so that they can get on with talking about what it is that they want to, which is what Labour plans to do in government.
Israel says it's restricted gatherings in the north of the country ahead of any possible retaliation by Hezbollah. Earlier, Israel carried out widespread airstrikes in southern Lebanon. Andrea Tenenti, a spokesperson for the UN peacekeeping mission in the Lebanese capital Beirut, said there were fears that they're on the brink of a wider conflict.
Definitely the situation now is really concerning, and the escalations of these days also very worrying, and all actors need to immediately de-escalate. A solution is still possible, but of course you need a commitment of the parties, and at the moment the situation is more than concerning that could potentially escalate to a wider conflict, and not only a conflict between Hezbollah and Israel, but a regional conflict.
The broadcaster Al Jazeera has said Israeli forces have raided its offices in the occupied West Bank. The Qatari-owned network said it's now been ordered to shut operations there for the next 45 days. Donald Trump's turned down the offer of a second televised debate with Kamala Harris ahead of the US presidential election in November. Speaking at a rally in North Carolina, he said it was too late. BBC News.
On Radio 4, the more you listen, the more you see.
We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
A US presidential election is looming, but underneath, conspiracy culture rears its head once again. And nothing is as it seems.
All those things that we had feared our whole lives was coming true.
Burn the house down and start over. That seems to be the way.
It's America through the looking glass. Join me, Gabriel Gatehouse, as the coming storm continues. Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Lisa McCormick.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
Well, it's that time again. It's time when we bring you one of the best podcasts from BBC Science. And tonight, it's one of my favourites, Access All, which explores some really important issues around disability and mental health. Now, tonight, research has revealed that the quality of life for some people with learning disabilities can decline after they hit 40. During the study, Manchester Metropolitan University came across cases of people who were still being cared for by their parents and others that were being sent to bed at 5 o'clock. Presenter Emma Tracy asked the lead researcher, Professor Sarah Ryan, why this is happening and what can be done to improve the situation. And a little later on in the episode, you're also going to hear from Labour's Marie Tidball, giving an insight into her early days in office as a high-profile, newly elected, disabled MP.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I absolutely love you listeners, and I will tell you for why. Because your emails are epic. Can I say thank you to Gail, who got in touch with us when she found us on Five Live one night when she couldn't sleep. So thank you for going on and subscribing after that. Very good idea if you're listening on Five Live. Gail is blind and in her 70s, and she's really enjoyed the Paralympics coverage. So we really, really appreciate that. Also, thank you to Jane, who wrote in. Now, Jane found us through a post on Matt Ford's Instagram. Matt Ford was one of our guests at Edinburgh. He's a political comedian, but he had some nerves cut when he was getting cancer removed from his spine, and he now has to use a catheter when going for a wee. And he talks about that quite a lot. And also, this is in Jane's future. So she was really, really interested in that. She listened because she saw it on Matt Ford's socials. And then she went back to the beginning of 2024 and listen to every single episode. Jane, I love you. But Jane said what particularly caught her attention in the Matt Ford episode was the naming of disability equipment, attachments, etc. Because she has always done that but didn't realise it was a thing. She tells us about her gallstone called Gary. He doesn't really cause much trouble, apparently. He's pretty silent. So that's good. Well done, Gary. But also her catheters. Now, her first catheter was called Clive, and he was supposed to work 24/7, but he literally just stopped, knocked off whenever he liked. So that was Clive the catheter. After that, she got a catheter called Camilla. Why is it called Camilla? Because she says, if you're going to have a pipe up your urethra, it needs to be a queen. Love that. And she says that it's a bit sort of difficult if she kind of does a big bow, kind of hurts a bit. So she has to do a curtsy. So that even sticks with the royal theme. Jane said she wasn't sure that she could call herself disabled. She's autistic. She's got some mental health stuff going on and some physical health as well. But having listened, she feels like Access All are her people. And we think you're our person too. Welcome to the gang, Jane, and thank you so much for your incredible email. Can you do better than Jane? If you think so, email accessall@bbc.co.uk. And don't forget to subscribe on BBC Sounds. On with the show.
I am proud of who I am.
When I was younger, I was told I could be anything.
Being deaf, if nothing wrong, it's such a joy to be deaf.
Live at the Apollo, hosting!
I'm on the autism spectrum, so I don't really care about social codes.
They're bringing into the question, should your child exist when he's just on the swings next to you?
Wouldn't it be great if everybody had someone to speak to where you could offload all of your week's grief?
Welcome to Access All, the BBC's weekly disability and mental health podcast. I'm Emma Tracy, and on this week's episode, we find out what happens to people with learning disabilities as they hit the age of 40. And Paul Carter speaks to one of the new disabled MPs, Marie Tidball. Turning 40 can be a tricky milestone for many of us, but it's particularly difficult for many people with learning disabilities. New research from Manchester Metropolitan University has found that when you're a member of this community, hitting 40 means that your levels of fulfillment drop considerably. Now, that's down to a lack of social opportunities and access to meaningful activities. The researchers want that to change, and joining me now to tell me more about it is Pam, who has learning disabilities herself. Hi, Pam.
Hello.
Now, you work for My Life, My Choice, which is a charity led by adults with learning disabilities. What does your job involve?
My role is a consultant at the charity to oversee all of our projects, which is quality checks, which is going in and inspecting people's homes to make sure they're safe and livable and they're well looked after in their own homes.
Well, that sounds like really important and useful and sometimes fun work as well, Pam.
Yes, it is, yeah.
Also joining me is Professor Sarah Ryan from Manchester Metropolitan University, who led the research called Growing Older with a Learning Disability and who got Pam involved as well. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Why did you choose to lead on research around getting older with a learning disability?
I was working with a small charity in Oxfordshire around older family carers. It was a big lottery-funded project. And we went to people's houses where they were in their 70s and 80s and they were still caring for a daughter or a son with learning disabilities who was in their 50s or 60s. I just didn't realise that people cared for that long. And I just didn't really understand why people being cared for, the people with learning disabilities, weren't living independent lives as they should be. So that sort of sparked off an interest in doing this research, which we were funded by the National Institute of Health and Care Research. And we set out to find good support for people with learning disabilities as they grow older. Researchers would spend time with people who lived in those houses, homes, and find out what was good about it and how we could replicate that good to spread across the country, because obviously a lot of people with learning disabilities lead very poor lives.
Tell me about some of the people that you met and some of the main findings from this research.
The researchers thought they were going to be spending time where people were leading very good lives, fulfilling lives and aging with meaning, which is what the World Health Organization says. People with learning disabilities have a right to lead lives as they grow older that are full and meaningful. And we found that quite a few people that we spent time with didn't, and the provision wasn't good.
And what kind of stories did you hear about people who weren't living the lives they wanted? So you already talked about people who were caring for and being cared for by, you know, older parents who were coming to the end of their lives. What other stories did you hear about people who weren't being fulfilled, who were older with a learning disability?
We heard about people who were put to bed at 5 o'clock every evening with the radio on. We heard about people who lived in a house with people that they really didn't get on with, and they'd lived together for about 10 or 15 years in one case. We heard about people who lived in shared life settings. So supposedly they lived with another family. So you live with another family, fair enough, maybe, although that family is going to grow older. So you're going to reach the same problems that you do if you stayed with your own family. But in one part of the country where we spent time with shared lives providers, in the daytime, people with learning disabilities were sent to a day centre, which was literally a room for the whole day where the television was on. People were just bored.
Pam, you worked with Sarah on this. What was your role in the research?
We co-produced the project. My role was just doing the interviews and seeing who wanted to be on the project and be involved in the research.
Were you surprised at what you found? What were the things that were most surprising to you?
People being shoved in rooms and not actually getting out and living in the community and enjoying the community like most of us.
Yeah. Were you surprised at that?
I was very surprised, yeah.
You went abroad, Pam, to talk about the findings of the research. You went to Iceland. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, we went to Iceland and presented at the Iceland conference. Yeah, we presented there and it was the best presentation they've heard all day. So it was really enjoyable to actually get out and take it somewhere else.
And for both of you, when you've talked to other countries about your research, have you found that it's the same in other places? Where does the UK stand in terms of older people with learning disabilities and their quality of life?
Here in England, we sort of have poor care. We don't treat people like they're humans, which allows them to be very abused and impoverished in terms of not enjoying their lives. There's no aspiration. There's no expectation that people will have relationships, get married, have children, go to work. And so when people grow older, their life has been the same as it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Pam, you worked on the study, but you also have your own experiences as a woman of a certain age with a learning disability. Tell me about those.
I struggled at school and college when I was younger. I did get a good job. Now I can live in the community and enjoy my life and go to gigs and events and stuff.
So you're very independent. How have you managed to achieve that, Pam, when so many people in your situation are struggling to be fulfilled?
Well, through my life, my choice, and being part of that charity, it's made loads of new friends, and getting out in the community is a great idea. I mean, I've managed to get in the community myself by fighting for the community. I'm now married, happily married, 26 years nearly.
Oh, wow.
And and I have stepchildren, so I'm very happy living in the community and being part of my life, my choice.
Have you got friends? Well, you've just told me you've got lots of friends with learning disabilities. Do many of them have the quality of life that you have, Pam, or are you particularly lucky, do you think?
No, a lot of them have good lives. There's a lot that's been shoved in, like day centres and just doing plastics into boxes and sorting out plastic, which is not a good life, I think.
So boring jobs. So they might have a job, but it's not fulfilling.
No, it's not fulfilling, no.
Okay. Sarah, why do so many people have these bad experiences? You mentioned sort of difficulties around care. Is it also around awareness in wider society of learning disability and of what's needed?
I think there's an ignorance that people are treated in ways that isn't really seen. It's almost like if you have a learning disability, professionals who've had all that training, all that experience, just stop seeing the person, just see a learning disability, and then lose any sense in terms of what they're doing. If you sort of think, even in our research, finding people put to bed at 5 o'clock with a radio, people weren't allowed drinks after 6 p.m. 50 or 60 years, could you imagine not being allowed to go in the kitchen and get a drink?
Yeah.
Being put to bed at 5 p.m. and then be in that bed for the next, it's over half a day, isn't it? 5 p.m. and then get up at 9 or something. 16 hours of the day you are in bed. I mean, that is barbaric.
It's a massive lack of stimulation, isn't it? But Sarah, many of the professional bodies who are looking at the quality of care for older people with learning disabilities might say that the system is working because these people have access to good food, they have access to decent lodgings. I mean, you've mentioned many of the problems, but what, you know, I guess it's hard for a professional body to say something is wrong if the basic needs are met.
That's so interesting, because that's what the Care Quality Commission used to do. It used to be, are you safe, well-fed, clean? If you were, then you've got a good life, you get a good rating. But that is no life at all. You have to lead a life, and our research found a good life is a life that's growing. A good life is a life when you do different things, where you go out and about and you mix with people and you do what you like. And if you love being out in the fresh air, you go out in the fresh air. That's what a life is.
What are the changes that you would like to see to make sure that as many older people with learning disabilities in England can live the lives they want?
I think money's a feature, obviously, because of the social care cuts that we've had and being in a period of austerity. But it's not just about money, because one provider that we spent time with, everybody they supported had a key worker, and they changed that key worker after 6 months so the person didn't get too attached to them. The basics of good care is affection, is to like the person you're supporting. That doesn't cost money. That's about culture.
Pam, what would you like to see change?
Getting people out into the community and enjoying the life they should be enjoying and not stuck in rooms.
And what do you hope happens now that you've done this research? What do you hope this research will do?
Hopefully it'll get people in the community where they belong, in the right support.
Well, Pam, keep doing what you're doing, and Sarah the same. Pam and Sarah Ryan, thank you very much for joining me. We contacted the government about some of the things that Sarah Ryan and Pam said in this episode, and they told Access All,
"We are determined to tackle the significant challenges facing social care head on. This government is committed to ensuring everyone is able to live independent, dignified lives."
And a spokesperson for the Care Quality Commission said, "In addressing recommendations of where care has fallen far short, we developed an approach that improves the CQC's ability to identify and take appropriate regulatory action in services that fail to meet the needs and aspirations of people with a learning disability and autistic people."
Do you remember when I interviewed someone from every major party apart from Reform UK, because they didn't put anyone up, in the run-up to the general election? Now, I asked them how many disabled people they had standing for election, and some of them didn't really know, and it is a bit complicated, to be fair. But after that, John Pring and the Disability News Service put in a Freedom of Information request. And now they wanted to know how many members of the new parliament had discussed disability-related adjustments and whether they would possibly need them. And the result that came back was 43. More than 20 of those went on to have their adjustments agreed. And there were less than 10 disabled MPs in the previous parliament. Obviously, that's not definitive number of disabled MPs because some don't disclose that they have a disability. But it is looking like it's far more disabled people in this parliament than it was in the previous one, which had around 10 disabled MPs. Now, one new MP who is very open about her disability is Labour's Marie Tidball. She has a disability affecting her four limbs. And shortly after she was elected, she spoke to Paul Carter about settling into her job, finding an accessible office space, and about what more there is to do to make politics more accessible.
Marie Tidball is the Labour MP for Penistone and Stocksbridge and has a formidable task ahead of her. She's pledged to smash the glass ceiling, which is currently preventing more disabled people from getting elected. Before she entered the Commons, Dr. Tidball, to give her her official title, had a long career as an academic and briefly as a journalist, and she's been a lifelong disability campaigner. Hello, Marie. Welcome to Access All. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Now, obviously, people who are listening to this won't be able to see, but I can see on my screen, you appear to be in quite a grand-looking location. Whereabouts are you at the moment?
I'm in a ladies' members' room because none of us have proper offices yet, none of us new MPs. So we're just all trying to find little places that we can work that are quiet and do things like this.
How are you settling into life as an MP? I mean, I know it's not been very long yet.
It has been a whirlwind because we came down to Parliament on the Monday straight after having been elected on the Thursday. And I have to say that parliamentary staff have been incredible. I spoke to the workplace adjustment team almost straight away. They rang me on the Saturday after I'd been elected. They've done a really brilliant job working out what support I would need and any help with day-to-day things before I get staffed, because being a Labour gain, happily, I don't have a staff team in place that I can take on from the previous MP. So that's quite a long process. And so I'm in the process of recruiting PAs to help me with some disability-related support, diary management, that kind of thing. And then I'll have my full constituency and Westminster staff team. So it's quite a lot of work, but it's been really great. And I was sworn in. They did a special session with some of the other disabled MPs so that we didn't have to queue for very long, which really, really helped. And also working out ways to reserve a seat for me in chamber without me having to go down early in the morning and do that myself.
What was campaigning like for you?
I discovered not long after I'd been selected that I'm the first person in over 100 years to have grown up in my constituency to go on to become its Member of Parliament. And it was just such a poignant part of the campaign. You know, when I was door knocking, I met teachers that I hadn't seen for 20 years. I also bumped into my special care baby unit nurse when I was out on the campaign trail, who hadn't seen me since I was really tiny. And for her, when I was born, they didn't know how long I would live for and what operations I might need. So the fact that she just turned around and saw me on the doorstep was, yeah, a thoroughly emotional moment.
Do you have any specific access needs or reasonable adjustments you needed?
So it was challenging, but because I'd been a councillor and a cabinet member previously, I kind of knew what to expect. And early on, the key thing for me was motivating lots of people to come and help with the campaign. So my crew of drivers were just fantastic and had great tunes along the way as well.
always helps. You've got to have tunes, right? And so I'm sure you'll be aware there used to be the Enable Fund for elected office, which offered grants of between £250 and £40,000 to support disabled candidates standing for election. I mean, it isn't available anymore. Is that something that would have been helpful to you, do you think?
Definitely think it would have been at different points. I think it's useful to have an overall sense of what disabled people might need and sharing our experiences. And there was a lot more resource available in terms of staff time. But I think generally that does need to be there. And possibly, you know, even thinking about the kind of support that could help disabled candidates across all parties during the selection process, because that's another segment which is got its own barriers and its own issues. So, you know, I'm really proud that the party overall has said that we very much want to learn from the benefits from the all-women's shortlist that Labour put in place in the Equality Act back in 2010 to make sure that we are looking at how we increase and improve representation at all levels of government. And I think that's very exciting to me because we know there are 40 million people in this country who have a disability, 20% of the working age population, and we definitely need to have more of us in Parliament. And so it's working about how we can, you know, remove those barriers and make that more accessible for more disabled people.
Yeah, so you've touched on it there. So, I mean, how do we go about making that change? I mean, you mentioned women-only shortlists there, for example. I mean, what about disabled-only shortlists? How would that work?
So it's something that I've written about in the past and how you might want to make that change. I think having spoken to kind of lots of people within the disability community and other disabled friends, I think there's views on both sides and whether they think it would work for them. But I think there has to be an open conversation and put forward the benefits and disbenefits and come to a consensus collectively on what they think might work. But for me at this stage, it's also about kind of opening up those processes to describe the things that work well for me and bits of advice that I can give in terms of things that help. So as I say, the way to kind of balance your time during a long campaign, because I was a candidate for 2 years, so it was a long slog.
And as we mentioned, you know, it's only been a few weeks. How are you finding the House of Commons and the parliamentary estate in terms of accessibility? Because, you know, as we all know, it is a very old building and a very old estate. How are you finding, you know, just basic things like getting around and being able to do your job?
Yeah, so, well, at the moment we don't have offices, but no new MPs have offices yet. The whips on our side have been really supportive in talking to me about what my needs would be, what would make it most accessible. I'm hoping to potentially go and look at a possible office this afternoon. The key thing has been how helpful the staff have been in Parliament in terms of assisting people to navigate around the space. And it is long distances, and I very much plan my time so that I do the things that I need to do when I'm in certain parts of the building, so that I don't have to kind of go back and forth across different bits of the estate. And, you know, when I get my diary manager in place in September, we'll very much be working with them to make sure that they consider that there are accessible routes around most of it. And all of the doorkeepers and other staff members here and the security are really good at pointing those out and where the lifts are. So a lot of it is really about time management and thinking about where you've got to get to at what point. So that is a bit of a challenge, and it's a challenge because I find it difficult to carry lots of heavy things. But there have been parliamentary staff that while I don't have my own team, have been really helpful in helping to get bags across the estate for me when I need that. And we've got lockers on site.
It was recently announced that Stephen Timms is the new Minister of State for Social Security and Disability. Mm-hmm. That's quite a big brief. Disability campaigners are asking how much time he'll actually have to take on the challenges facing disabled people.
He's an extremely experienced parliamentarian. He's worked in the Treasury previously. I've no doubt that he is absolutely suited and will be able to meet and rise to that challenge, and is already doing so. But what I'm really enthused about is that right across our manifesto, because we had the missions, each of them were very much seen to be intersecting, and disability was considered right across the piece. And speaking to quite a lot of my cabinet colleagues at different times over the last 2 years, as I have, I know so many of them are really passionate that disability is woven through absolutely everything that we do. And, you know, so if we just think about, for example, mandatory disability pay gap reporting, that's front and centre of what we've said we want to happen for organisations over 250 people. We want to make sure that there's stronger family-friendly rights, including carers' leave in our New Deal for Working People. I'm thrilled that if you look at every single strand of each of the missions, there is thinking about where disability is relevant, you know, making sure inclusive living is a principle that's at the heart of the work that we do on independent living. Yes, Stephen's got a big job, but he's absolutely up to that. And I know we'll do that really, really well.
But surely you can understand people's concerns. I mean, we've seen a lot of conversation about this, that wouldn't it help to have a minister whose brief is solely disability, you know, as it has been in previous governments?
Well, I think Stephen will deal with the job really well and in the portfolio he has. And I'm very much a believer that the approach that the UN takes is the right approach, which is, you know, you look at how you can weave disability in across all areas from a very general perspective. And then you have a focus on specialist areas. And that's what Stephen will be doing. And I think actually there is a value to making sure that it's not just seen to be relevant to one minister's brief, because actually we get a much more inclusive parliament, a much more inclusive government, if everybody recognises it's relevant right across the piece.
And you mentioned a lot of the policies and initiatives that the government are planning around disability. I mean, I guess the big question is how long is all of this going to take to enact?
I know that there's a real drive to move at pace with the work on making sure that access to work is improved. And we've seen a real negative growth in the waiting list for that and workplace adjustments as a result. And the Labour Party is really determined to try and speed that up. And I think that's something that they're really keen to pursue as quickly as possible.
So we mentioned you're an academic too. You had a book out earlier this year called Disabling yeah. Criminal Justice. Can you tell me a little bit about that and what that was about?
Yeah, so Disabling Criminal Justice is about the treatment of autistic adult defendants in the English criminal justice system. And I did a piece of work that involved research following 8 autistic defendants through the court process over a number of years. When I was following the defendants through the court process, I ended up getting to know and sitting with, often while I was watching the cases, their family members. And so one of the chapters is about the impact of that process on their family members. And again, that wasn't something that had really been looked at previously. It was tough to write sometimes, and really wanted to make sure that I'd done a thorough job. So I hope there's some really meaty material for people to get their teeth stuck into.
So I guess between being a campaigner, an MP, an academic, a mum, your life sounds incredibly busy. I mean, what do you do to let off steam?
That very much is the case. but happily so. Well, I love spending time with my little one, do quite a lot of creative things together. I haven't had a chance to do it for a long time, but I really, really enjoy doing a bit of drawing and painting myself. I'm also a bit of a gardener. We used to have an allotment many, many years ago. And although we've got quite a small garden now, I really enjoy doing that. It's probably the only thing that stops me thinking about work. I'm a bit of a telly addict too, I have to confess.
Thanks so much, Marie. Good luck with the new job and thanks for chatting to us.
Thanks ever so much.
It's a wee while, a few weeks since that chat was recorded. So we went back to Marie's people to find out whether she's managed to get the adjustments she needs. So a diary manager, accessible office. And she sent us this voice note.
Hello. So I'm 2 months into the job right now and some things have changed after a very intensive summer of recruiting my team. I've now got all my staff in post, so I'm really delighted about that. Within that team, I've got some disability related support, which has been amazing and really, really helpful with particularly the long days in Parliament. And extra support in terms of taking dictation and helping to organise my diary and carrying bags and things around the enormous parliamentary estate. I've also now got my office set up in Westminster. Our whips have absolutely outdone themselves. It's a really great location, which means that I can get to the chamber in quick time and the office is really accessible for me. So that really feels fantastic to have moved forward on those areas and really start to hit the ground running as the Member of Parliament for my constituency. It also means that I've been able to focus on making contributions in the chamber. So in our second week back, I asked 3 questions to different ministers on issues that were important in our constituency. And that was really important to me, including raising an issue around a domestic violence issue that happened a number of years ago and getting the agreement of the minister to meet with me and the mother of the 2 victims who sadly died. I also asked about issues around Yorkshire Water and sewage in our beautiful River Don and the weight that our local people have to be able to get to speak to their GPs. So it really feels like we are doing the best for our constituents now that we've got everything up and running and in place. and looking forward to having my first advice surgeries over the coming weeks and making sure that we're doing that very regularly around the constituency too.
Thank you for listening. Thanks to Paul Carter for chatting to Marie Tidball when I was on my holidays. Thanks to Sarah and Pam for chatting to me about life when you're getting older and have a learning disability. If you want to get in touch with us about any of the things we've discussed in this episode or any other episode, frankly, because you guys are epic with the emails, you can contact us on accessall@bbc.co.uk, or you could pop on to the WhatsApp and you could send us a voice message or a text message. Just start with the word access and send it to 0330 123 9480. We are also on the socials at BBC Access All. Thanks for listening. See you later. Bye.
That's the latest episode of Access All. And of course, you can access all of the episodes on BBC Sounds. It's 4:34 now.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Time for the news headlines, and Sakir Starmer says he'll take responsibility for leaks coming from his government, which he says damages everybody. It emerged this week that his top adviser, Sue Gray, was paid more than him amid signs of disquiet in his top ranks. The Prime Minister was speaking ahead of Labour's first party conference in government in 15 years. The Crown Prosecution Service says it's considered bringing charges against the former Harrods owner Mohammed Al-Fayed twice, but on both occasions it concluded there was no realistic prospect of a conviction. More than 100 women have come forward with allegations of being sexually assaulted or raped by the billionaire who died last year. Israel's imposed restrictions on civilian movements in the north of the country after it carried out airstrikes on Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon. A spokesman said that the order was in anticipation that Hezbollah would retaliate. Reports in the West Bank say Israeli forces have ordered the broadcaster Al Jazeera to close its office in Ramallah for 45 days. And Kamala Harris has challenged Donald Trump to a second debate in the run-up to November's presidential election. The vice president's campaign team said the Democratic candidate had accepted an invitation from CNN for another head-to-head next month, but Mr. Trump has ruled it out. Time for the sport now. Here's Andy Barwell.
A destructive performance from Daniel Dubois on the biggest night of his life. The IBF title holder knocked out the two-time unified world champion Anthony Joshua in round five of their heavyweight boxing clash at Wembley Stadium. And afterwards, Dubois said he still had to reach his full potential. How will Manchester City react today, having been joined level on points by Liverpool and Aston Villa in the Premier League title race? In fact, Liverpool are top on goal difference, although boss Arne Slot said it wasn't easy in beating Bournemouth 3-0 at Anfield. Villa fought back to defeat Wolverhampton Wanderers 3-1, and City's game in hand this afternoon looks to be a real blockbuster. It's against Arsenal at the Etihad Stadium. Rangers and Aberdeen reached the last four of the Scottish League Cup. Celtic faced Falkirk in the last of the quarter-finals. Cricket, England went 2-0 down in their five-match one-day international series, with Australia winning at Headingley by 68 runs. Sunrisers lifted the women's Rachel Hayo Flint trophy for the first time as they beat South East Stars by 27 runs. Today it's the turn of the men's 50-over final, with Somerset taking on Glamorgan at Trent Bridge. In Rugby Union's Premiership, there were wins for Leicester Tigers and for Saracens. Dragons were winners of the first Welsh derby of the new United Rugby Championship season. They defeated Ospreys. Lando Norris in the McLaren is on pole position for today's Singapore Formula One Grand Prix. And the Italian player Matteo Manassero on 18 under par leads by three shots going into the final round of golf's European Tour PGA Championship at Wentworth.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Hello. Well, this weekend's already got off to a lively start with lots of thunderstorms already recorded across England and Wales, quite a few with hail and some quite large hail across parts of the Midlands on Saturday. Anyway, into Sunday's forecast, here we go, and thunderstorms that have been brewing in France are going to move into England and Wales, where they'll become very heavy, very slow-moving in nature, and it means that through the course of Sunday, there could be some areas that see pretty much a month's worth of rain, and so there is a threat of seeing some localised flooding building in as we go through the day on Sunday. Sunday. The far north of England probably staying dry, actually. For Cumbria, there should be some sunshine here, but the northeast of England more likely to keep some low cloud and mist for much of the day. Northern Ireland doing pretty well. There'll be some sunshine here and sunny skies too for western Scotland. Central and eastern Scotland could well have lingering low cloud and mist for much of the day. Now, temperatures for most areas of the UK on Sunday, 17 to 21 degrees Celsius. Not feeling too bad, but around 13 or 14 degrees where that low cloud sticks near to North Sea coast. And then through the rest of the week, it is going to be unsettled, rain at times, and it will eventually turn much cooler for all of us. Chris Fawkes, Five Live Weather.
BBC Radio 5 Live, the home of Formula One.
Oscar Piastri wins the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. He takes his second Formula One win in the last five races.
Exciting times in F1.
This afternoon from 1.
Marina Bay Street Circuit.
Singapore.
Can Red Bull turn around their fortunes on a track that they haven't got good history at, or are McLaren in a league of their own now?
Listen to live coverage of every lap
on Five Sports Extra and BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
Lisa McCormick.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Well, the US presidential election's just a few weeks away and the polls are predicting another very close race. It's likely to come down to just a handful of swing states, and Georgia is one of them. That's where the BBC's Jordan Dunbar has been for the last week. And earlier I caught up with him and started by asking him what the mood's like in the state at the moment.
So we have gone from the very north, the border with Tennessee, Dolly Parton country, all the way down Atlanta, kind of in the middle, the big Democrat city. And now we are at the Savannah River, where the river runs into the Atlantic. All completely different places with completely different political outlooks. And I'm sat here on the river. One Direction, I've got one of those classic southern steam paddle boats that you see in the film, the Georgia Queen. And then the other direction, I've got this massive new port, because the amount of money and the amount of jobs and the economy here has been incredible in Georgia.
Yeah, so I mean, you've been right across the state, you've spoken to a lot of people. What have voters been telling you, Jordan?
Well, what's been really interesting is no matter where we go and whatever political stripe people might be from or whether they're undecided, they all have very common themes. I mean, recently Kamala Harris has gone on the attack with women's rights, and that's really struck a chord with women right across the state. But there is one common thread that everybody has. So I spoke with three voters. These are from completely different places and political backgrounds. See if you can see what their common concern is.
I don't know, I think the cost of living has just, you know, there's aspects of, you know, the housing rent. It's made things unaffordable for people who work in jobs that are, you know, just blue collar.
Like a lot of people around here.
Yeah, a lot of people that work here for me. As a matter of fact, they couldn't survive with, you know, the cost of rent, and they're in my opinion, poverty level, where rent's not affordable, they have to have assistance. Most of my employees here are on some sort of government help, whether it be food stamps or medical or, you know, just about everything that you can think of.
I want a president who's going to actually do stuff for America, not just for themselves, because I personally don't like Trump, but that's just... his views don't align with mine. Kamala Harris really doesn't either, but she's the lesser of two evils. Because Trump, I don't like what he stands for. When he was in office, he divided this country tenfold, and I didn't like that. Because, once again, I like being with community, and I like everyone liking each other, not it being race or sexuality dividing the country.
The economy, jobs, and women's rights. Honestly, I'm obviously a woman, so I would like to be able to choose what I would want to have go on with my body and what goes on with me. So that's really my main concern. I would like for, obviously, the world to get back to where you can afford to do our normal things, like get food and gas and everything else. But besides that, then I don't really have concerns besides that, because I feel like that's the main thing that we need to get back to so that people can survive.
It's jobs and the economy, which is really interesting, because you can probably hear behind me there's some beautiful piano music and there's a lot of really high-end shops, lots and lots of tourists, lots of really nice hotels here in Savannah. And to be honest, that's been the story most places we've gone. The economy's absolutely booming. Wages here in America and in Georgia are much, much higher than in the UK. Yet, everybody keeps saying it's hitting their pocket. Inflation has run rampant. So going out for dinner, going out for beer, going to the theatre or football games, that's got so much more expensive. And that has got people blaming, the Democrats blaming Biden because inflation was on his watch. And it's really surprised me because the reason we've come down to this river is right in front of me there is a huge, huge container ship that's full of electric vehicles. They're all being built in Georgia with money that's come from the Democrats to build these new factories, and they're going to be heading out around the world creating those decent paying jobs. And yet, even as the economy booms, people are not happy.
It's interesting, that one, isn't it, Jordan? I mean, have you been surprised by what people have been telling you?
I have, yeah. I think a lot of the preconceived notions that I had coming over here have definitely been changed. We spoke with a Republican here in Georgia who's an evangelical Christian. He's a diehard Republican, and he is so for electric vehicles. And he's been working in his job in the state of bringing over Kia and Hyundai to build electric vehicles here to get solar panel factories, part of clean energy for conservatives, which, to be honest, I think most people wouldn't know existed. Another thing that surprised me is the Inflation Reduction Act. This was what Biden passed about 2 years ago, and it had about $800 billion for the climate, for green tech jobs. Even climate activists here have never heard of that. Democrats here have never heard of it. Republicans don't care about it. But this is a massive missed opportunity for the Democrats. People just aren't joining the dots from the billions of dollars flowing into Georgia to the White House.
Really interesting. I mean, what's the feeling then about this election in the state? Is it clear what way it's going to go, do you think?
I don't know. What's been interesting is I thought when I came over here I'd speak to sort of red and blue and they'd be diehard one way, Harris or Trump the other. But honestly, everyone I've spoken to, whether a Republican or a Democrat, seems really tired and fed up. And they'll say, yeah, I will vote for X, but I'm not delighted. And there's been a lot of purple, a lot of undecided voters. And sadly, I've spoken to a lot of people that just said, I'm not going to vote at all. I don't care. I just want it to be over. I think a lot of people are worried about the division it's causing. And one person said, the election's the start, but afterwards the hard work starts. We've got to bring the country back together again. So I'm surprised at the reluctance of a lot of people in how they're going to vote.
Yeah, and turnout could be key in this election. I mean, I know you went to a voter registration party earlier in the week. So what was that like?
Yeah, so that was, again, really interesting because this election in these swing states, and particularly Georgia, is not going to come down to convincing a Republican to vote Democrat or vice versa. What it's really going to be about is getting the turnout, whether it be in rural areas or in urban areas. So we were at Sky Zone, this trampolining park, where they threw this big party to try and get disinterested people to come in and register to vote. And you could feel the energy there. I said to one guy, are you going to be glad when the election's over? And he said, no, this is just the start. We've just stepped on the pitch. The game's just started. You could really feel the energy. And that is going to work in the favour of the Democrats. The cities here, if you imagine it, the state's red with these big islands of blue. But if they can get the people out in the cities and urban areas, that could very well swing it for Harris.
So, Jordan, talking about Georgia, has it always been a close contest in the past?
Georgia's really interesting. So, for a very, very long time, this was a Republican state, and it was just taken as a Republican state. It wasn't until Bill Clinton in 1992, he flipped it for the Democrats. Then it went through 30 years of Republicans until Joe Biden won by 12,000 votes. Now, this is a state of 11 million people, so that's like 0.2% of the electorate. Absolute knife edge, which is why both sides have been throwing money and people into Georgia to try and get as many people out to vote for them.
And the Democrats are spending a lot more than the Republicans. Does it feel like it?
Yeah, well, when you're in the city, you definitely see more people out. And I'm talking about Atlanta, where I am, in Savannah, and maybe Athens and Augusta. And so in those urban areas, you will definitely see more Democrat activists. You get a lot of NGOs, which we don't necessarily do in the UK. They would say they're non-partisan, but they'll be out for things like women's rights, which is absolutely huge in this election, and climate change, which we've been covering. They are definitely more prevalent, and they are left-leaning. definitely. So you do see more of those compared to the Republicans. But if you go to the country, you will see Trump flags, Trump... Everyone's got... Basically, the front garden is a political battleground. And wherever you go, they've got the big signs and the bumper stickers and the flags.
It's exactly how I imagined it would be. Is it how you imagined it to be? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Although, do you know what? The nicest thing has been, as much as it's divided, and it's been like, it's been quite a mad election so far, particularly with those two assassination attempts, people have been very kind, very generous, and willing to talk. And it's been a lot nicer and a lot more civil than I was worried about.
Jordan, it's good to talk to you about your experiences there. And but you are there for a reason as well. You're recording a podcast. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so the climate question is doing this election special, which is why we're here. And as I've been talking about electric vehicles being manufactured here and the billions of dollars going into the clean economy, we've really come over to see what part climate action and climate change is playing in the US election here. Been fascinating. We spent the day with an interfaith climate group that's bringing together Christians of all stripes, and they're trying to take the politics out of climate action. And their argument is, it's too important to leave it to one party or the other. And it was a really good news story to see people from either side of the divide get together on a common issue. And you'll be able to hear that wherever you get your podcast from the 13th of October.
That's the BBC's Jordan Dunbar there, who's been spending time in Georgia ahead of the US presidential election. Well, women's football's back with the return of the WSL this weekend. Chelsea got their title challenge off on the right foot with a 1-0 win over Aston Villa on Friday night. And yesterday, Man United started their season with a win over West Ham, and Brighton came out 4-0 winners against Everton thanks to their new signing, Keiko Saka, scoring a hat-trick on a dream debut. But the big game of the weekend comes later on today when two title favourites go up against each other. Arsenal take on Man City in a lunchtime kick-off, and earlier I caught up with Wales' all-time top goal scorer, Helen Ward, to talk about what we can expect.
Arsenal, of course, starting at the Emirates, they'll want to make a good start on the season. They've had a tricky few years, you know, where you feel they're gonna go and do things, and they haven't quite done it. Again, in midweek, weren't convincing against Hacken in the Champions League and had a disappointing defeat there. But yeah, I think they've made some good signings, and again, it's just whether they've had the time to gel as well. So
yeah.
It's a really tough one to call, because Arsenal at the Emirates is a tough prospect. I think Manchester City are looking good, and I think they could potentially be one of the real big contenders against Chelsea for the league title. So I'm going to go Man City win, but...
Oh, okay.
Not much in it. Yeah,
they're pushing for it this year, definitely. Liverpool-Leicester. Liverpool finished fourth last year, but you know, there's talk of a relegation battle already. How do you see that playing out?
Yeah, I don't quite see where the relegation battle ideas come from. I know they haven't made bundles of new signings, but they've added to their squad with some quality, and they had a fantastic season last year. And I know sometimes when you have an unexpectedly good year, you're almost putting more pressure on yourselves, and that can sometimes weigh heavy. And you know, if you don't get a good start to the season, that could be tricky, but I see them being okay. I don't think that they'll finish fourth. I don't think they'll finish that high again, but I don't really see them being in too much trouble. And Leicester, again, it's not a bad start for them to have at home to Leicester. New ground, lots of excitement around Liverpool's new home stadium. So I see that as a Liverpool win. Leicester, I think for them, good season last year, but I think, again, it'll be all about staying up, you know, first and foremost. And then what can you do once you get to sort of a certain mark or in terms of points, how can you then push on? But yeah, I don't think either of them will be in too much trouble, but they're not going to be pushing for those European places. So it's kind of a mid-table one straight off the bat, in my opinion.
Yeah, fair. And finally, for the weekend's action, Crystal Palace taking on Spurs. Crystal Palace, of course, newly promoted. What are you making of their chances of survival, and how do you think they'll fare against Spurs?
Yeah, it's always really difficult as a championship team going up. We saw with Bristol City last year, really dominant in terms of the league, although it was closer in the end than it maybe should have been for Palace at the end of the season. Very young squad, very athletic, very energetic, but do they just lack that little bit of experience? They've made some really interesting signings as well, but quite late in the window. And I wonder how much time they've had to really plan for the season. I think they would have liked to have got their business done maybe a little bit earlier. But, you know, going away to Spurs on the first day is a tough one for them. But, you know, they could be a surprise package. They, as I said, they've got some really talented individuals, some of them untested at WSL level. But that's not to say that they're not ready for it. And then they brought in, you know, the likes of Josie Green, Lily Woodham, who've got good experience from internationally as well as their club football, and a number of other sort of loan signings as well. Lexi Potter coming back from Chelsea. She had a fantastic season for them last year, and she'll feel she's ready for the step up to the WSL. And I think, yeah, they could be a little bit of a surprise package. It could go one or two ways. They're either going to fly out the blocks or it's going to be right from the start. It's hard to predict. I think they could fare a little better than Bristol did last year, because I think the signings they have added to their group. However, it is a tough league to come into, and that gap between the Championship and WSL seems to be growing a little bit, rather than getting smaller. So it could be a long season for them, but I think they have made some signings that could make their life a little bit easier.
Good stuff. Helen, it's lovely to catch up with you. I feel like I want to catch up with you throughout the season, obviously, but at the end as well, to see where we're at. I mean, who do you reckon is going to take the title? And we're talking about this very early on, but, you know, if you were to bet on it right now.
I've got a sneaky feeling for Man City, you know, and I don't know why, but there's something telling me that if Viv Miedema and Bunny Shaw can click, the likes of Jess Park, Lauren Hemp, Chloe Kelly around them, it's quite frightening. It's quite a prospect. It'll be really close between them and Chelsea, but I think Man City might just pip it.
My daughter will be happy to hear that. We're taking her to her first games this season. It's all about City. And it's really good to speak to you. Thank you so much for taking the time for us.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
That's Wales' all-time top goal scorer, Helen Ward, there, talking me through this weekend's action in the WSL. Now, we've just got time to revisit one of my favourite topics from this weekend: animals behaving badly. We challenged you to call in with your stories about your encounters with animals that are getting up to no good after a couple of high-profile examples hit the news this week, and you did not disappoint. So here's a few examples of animals behaving badly in the news, followed by some of the stories that you told me last night.
Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you?
The capybara that escaped from a zoo in Shropshire has been captured. Volunteers used a thermal drone and found Cinnamon in a field about 200 metres from her enclosure.
Unfortunately, while the gate was open for a short period of time, he hadn't noticed that Cinnamon was there and she snuck out around the side. So we've reviewed that now, made sure that can never happen again.
A GWR train service from Reading to Gatwick had to be cancelled as two squirrels decided to jump on board.
Alarmed passengers made their way along the train, and the train manager locked the rodents in the rear carriage. Staff tried unsuccessfully to shoo the squirrels off the train at Red Hill, but one of them wanted to stay on.
Scandinavian Airlines has said one of its flights had to make an unscheduled landing on Wednesday after a passenger discovered a mouse in her in-flight meal.
When the lady next to me opened her box of delicious food, seemingly, and out jumped a small mouse.
Bad boys, bad boys, what you gonna do?
And now I'm sat out there with a cup of coffee and a bacon sandwich, and I'm reading the local paper.
Yeah.
And I put the paper down, and straight in front of me, there's a whacking great big black bear.
Is
about
right.
Is about 6 foot from me.
Oh my goodness! What was your reaction?
I was changing my trousers. But anyhow, it sat on its haunches and it put its paw out.
Yeah.
Well, the first thing I thought, I give it the sandwich. So I give it the sandwich and it sat there eating the sandwich.
Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you?
He ran out to rescue this swan, which had been reported, covered in fish and line, really bad. So got to work on that, trying to undo that, dodging all the pecks and everything. I mean, they don't realise you're trying to help them, but dodging all the pecks and obviously got down to the last few strands of fishing line.
Yeah.
And I was doing this on top of an embankment, so the river was one side, and then it was like a ditch full of stinging. It was the other side. You can guess what happened. The swan broke through. It broke free, and,
yeah,
and I ended up in the stinging nettles, which were about 5 foot high, and went home looking like a lobster, full of little pimples and everything.
So the squirrel started off by jumping on my back.
Oh, really? That's
and then I met a chap who said, "Feed the squirrel has to have its own station, you know, feeding station."
Mm-hmm.
So I had a little feeding station outside my door for the squirrel, and I was putting down the peanuts for him, and he bit my finger right through to the bone.
Oh my goodness.
And it absolutely, you know, right through to the bone, just like that. So I just plunged it in disinfectant and have survived. Bad boys, bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you?
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 5 o'clock. This is Anna Cunningham. The British boxer Daniel Dubois has retained his IBF World Heavyweight title with a fifth-round knockout of the two-time former Unified Heavyweight Champion Anthony Joshua. 96,000 people watched the fight at Wembley Stadium. Dubois dominated the bout, knocking Joshua to the canvas multiple times. Speaking after the fight, he thanked his supporters.
It's been a long journey. I'm grateful to be in this position. God bless. I'm a gladiator, you know. I'm just a warrior to the end, to the bitter end, and I'm just ready to go. You know, I want to go to the top level of this game and reach my full potential. You know, behind the scenes, the work with my dad, you know, all my family and, you know, my strong team here, they've helped me get through this. So God bless you all, man.
The Crown Prosecution Service says it considered bringing charges against the former Harrods owner Mohammed Al-Fayed twice, but on both occasions it concluded there was no realistic prospect of a conviction. More than 100 women have come forward with allegations of being sexually assaulted or raped by the billionaire who died last year. Israel has imposed restrictions on civilian movements in the north of the country in case Hezbollah retaliates against its airstrikes in southern Lebanon. The authorities in Beirut say 37 people were killed on Friday in an attack on what Israel says was a Hezbollah stronghold. A local councillor, Ali Hakami, says the military action won't change anything.
People absorb the shock and they start their life again. It's hard, but this is the way we choose, and we will not stop. We have to defend our country. We have to defend our border. We have to defend our people from Israelis or from others.
Donald Trump has said he will not take part in another televised debate with Kamala Harris before the presidential election. The vice president has accepted an invitation from CNN to hold a second debate. Brian Anderson is a political journalist in North Carolina, where Mr. Trump is currently campaigning.
It's worth noting Trump says it's too late to debate, but if you remember back in 2016 and 2020, those debates were actually scheduled for later than September 21st.